Good afternoon. It's my pleasure today to introduce our NIH Director's Lecturer, Dr. Marcus Reichel. I've known him for many years. We just reminisced about some of the things we did together, not as scientists, because we didn't collaborate scientifically, but we collaborated on scientific strategy, and at many points in our career we interacted. And we just mentioned to me the observation he had about the expansion of medical imaging as a tool for asking deeper and deeper questions. And I think his career actually is a good reflection of exactly how you can marry both questions and tools in ways that you couldn't imagine really 30 years ago. Dr. Reichel received a bachelor's in medical degree from the University of Washington in Seattle, and he's a neurologist who joined the faculty at Washington University as a research instructor in neurology and radiology in 1971. He became a professor of neurology in 1978, professor of radiology in 1979. See, it takes longer to get a radiology professorship. It's a little tougher. And then professor of biomedical engineering in the same year, 1979. And professor of neurobiology in 1993. He was honored by the University of Washington as their distinguished alumnus in 2006, and his honors include election to the Institute of Medicine in 1991, the National Academy of Sciences in 1996, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1998. He's also received the Bristol-Myers Squibb Award for Distinguished Achievement in Neuroscience Research and the Graebmeier Award for Psychology. I think his initial contribution and what he's known for is his pioneering research in the development and use of an imaging technique called positron emission tomography to map specific brain areas used in tasks such as seeing, hearing, reading, the basic tasks. And really, the first time I heard about Marcus was in the late 70s. About his notion that you could use non-invasive, non-destructive methods to map the cognitive areas of the brain and brain function. And I really was surprised at the time that you could even think of using PET imaging. PET imaging relies on radioisotopes, and the temporal resolution of radioisotopes was not that great at the time. It takes you a long time to get the information. And I was always fascinated by that because there was a healthy competition between various institutions at the time, and Henry Wagner at Hopkins was thinking about imaging receptors, the dopamine receptor, and I also thought this was a completely crazy idea. And it tells you how wrong you can be in science, and I think he proved us wrong in the sense that, in fact, he has accomplished, in many ways, some of the early trailblazing work that has led then to the developments later of functional brain imaging, in addition to some of the early hypotheses, really, about specific brain locations that could have direct relevance to some pathologies. For example, in depression, he was one of the first ones to identify areas of low metabolism, low metabolic rates, which now are clearly becoming critical to our understanding of mental health disorders. So I'd like to essentially welcome him and have him share with us his trajectory. And he told me that he was going to take a risk today, which I think is the greatest thing to do in science, is never forget to take a risk, and really try to challenge us and stimulate our conversation around cognitive neurosciences. And his talk is A Default Mode of Brain Function, History of an Evolving Idea. It's my distinct honor to introduce Dr. Marcus Reichel.
Well, thank you, Elias, for that very kind introduction. It's indeed a pleasure and a privilege to be here and see so many friends who are here. The risk-taking today is not so much that I'm going to take a risk in challenging you. It's that, as I explained to Elias, this is the first time I've actually tried to give this particular talk, and I suspect many of you in this audience realize that you never know when something's going to work until you actually get up and do it. So bear with me. But the reason for bringing this up is that a number of years ago, we wrote a paper called A Default Mode of Brain Function, and it arose out of a problem that we were confronted with, which I'll tell you a bit about. And I've realized over the years that it's been a continuing challenge to help people understand where we came from and what we meant by this. And then what surprised me is where it's taken us in terms of the way we think about this whole matter, because I wouldn't have anticipated it at the time we first published this notion of a default mode. In fact, I can't even remember why we picked that or why I picked that title. I've often mused about that. The issue that is on the table here for me today to talk to you about is something that people in imaging have, anybody who has done anything in imaging has encountered, and that is the fact that if you engage in any kind of task with fMRI or PET or whatever your favorite imaging technique is concerned with, that you not only see task-relevant increases in various parts of the brain that are usually very clearly related to the task, but routinely you see areas like this in the brain that decrease their activity. And initially, we didn't even look at that side of the imaging agenda. But when it became apparent that these were present in the images, it was very difficult to understand how to even think about this. And one of the direction or the trajectory of this that's occurred for us is to not only grapple with this idea of what these are, and are they trivial or are they really meaningful, but what is the deeper meaning of encountering something like that? And over the course of the next few minutes, I want to suggest to you that the key idea that emerges out of this notion of a default mode is that the brain, one of the primary things that we need to be concerned about in the brain is its intrinsic activity. That is, that activity in the brain that is not directly related to a particular task of the moment, but rather, what is the brain really doing all of the time? And I'd like to refer to that as its intrinsic activity. And furthermore, I would like to suggest that if one is interested in understanding how the brain works, that the emphasis needs to focus on that intrinsic activity, because if one takes a purely economic view of the brain, we just figure out how much does it cost to run this and where is this money being spent, it is largely being spent on the intrinsic activity and not its evoked activity. So I want to kind of walk you through as how I ended up thinking about these things. I've written a number of things about this, a couple of things most recently, so if my remarks are less than fully articulate and comprehensive or comprehensible, I would suggest that there's a recent review in the annual reviews of neuroscience and something coming out in Neuroimage in which I've again tried to grapple with this. The ideas I want to put forth here are not the least bit new. People have noticed, have commented about this, these issues for millennia. In fact, it was Seneca in 69 who said that the brain is never at rest. Now, what gave him that insight, I'm not sure. But Immanuel Kant talked about that through all of our knowledge begins with experience, though it is by no means follows that all arises out of experience. For on the contrary, it is quite possible that our empirical knowledge is a compound of that which we perceive through our impressions and that which the faculty of cognition supplies from itself. And what's interesting from what Kant said about this is you move up to William James, and it's almost a paraphrase of that, but a phrase which I find very interesting, in when he said that enough has now been said to prove the general law of perception, which is this, that whilst part of what we perceive comes through our senses from the object before us, another part, and it may be the larger part, always comes out of our own head. And finally, Rodolfo Linus, who I think has been the most articulate person with regard to this whole matter, and he does it nicely in his book, Eye of the Vortex, but had written extensively about it before, that the significance of incoming sensory information, that which we as cognitive scientists, neuroscientists, spend a great deal of our time thinking about, or even neurophysiologists from that perspective, that the significance of this incoming depends on the pre-existing disposition of the brain is a far deeper issue than one gathers at first glance. So what all of these people, I think, are referring to in one way or another and from highly different perspective is that a very critical part of what the brain's doing is what I would call intrinsic activity. And we need to try to understand where that's likely to take us. I need to give you a little background, and given this audience, I'm afraid I'm going to have to say a few things up front that may seem very pedestrian, but I think it will help me tell this story in terms of the background itself. Obviously, the current era started in 1972 with the invention of CT, and as many of you remember, PET followed almost immediately. The concept evolved right out of the idea of the X-ray CT. And immediately we had in vivo tissue autoradiography. The late Paul Lauterberg clearly developed the ideas for MR in 1980, but it was 1991 when we had really viable images of the sort we use today. And as Elias mentioned, it was very quickly adopted were techniques that allowed us then to use changes in blood flow in the brain, or metabolism for that matter, in this case PET, in which we could identify areas of the brain that changed their activity when, in this case, a visual stimulus was presented. And then very quickly, image averaging techniques and subtraction techniques emerged on the scene and began to create images like this. And they're ubiquitous, whether it's Time magazine a month ago or the latest issue of Nature or Science. These kinds of images are everywhere. And I think they convey a very important message in terms of changes in activity within the brain. But there's something deceptive, in a way, about an image like that, because you see this very bright spot out sitting out here, and you see nothing behind it. And the implication is something very big and important has happened in that brain. And what's interesting about it is something very big and important has been subtracted away in the way of producing an image like that. So as we looked at this, the story itself began to look somewhat different than one might have expected. And that is, just as I showed you, is you, say, provide a visual stimulus, you get this increase in local blood flow in the brain, and as people that have used deoxyglucose autoradiography, Lou Sokoloff and their colleagues showed, there was an increase in glucose utilization, which PET clearly showed as well. But what was a huge surprise was that the increase in the oxygen consumption of the brain that attended these changes was far less. And this has both a interesting theoretical implications, but it had the very practical implication that when that happened, you had an increase in local oxygenation in the tissue. And that, of course, was something that played into a story that goes back many, many years. In fact, it was Michael Faraday in 1845 who said in one of his notebooks, having examined dried blood for its magnetic properties and found none, he wrote in his book that he should have tried wet blood. And it was Linus Pauling in 1937 who remembered that comment and proceeded to test the magnetic properties of blood itself, whole wet blood, if you will. And it was clear that when it loses its oxygenation, it disrupts a magnetic field. That was a seminal paper published the year I was born, actually. And it was, again, somebody, I guess, prepared for this kind of information, and that was Seiji Ogawa. Now, Seiji picked up his PhD at Stanford University as an MR physicist, and he was working on hemoglobin. So when the physiology and this information coincided in Seiji's mind, he realized there was a way for MR to observe these phenomena. And he did this very seminal experiment of having a rodent on room air, showing the veins in the brain of the rodent, and then just put it on 100% oxygen, and the veins disappeared. And he coined the term blood oxygen level dependent signal, or BOLD signal. And it, of course, is ubiquitously used throughout the world now to image the brain and produce pictures that look, of course, just like that. The thing that to me is so startling about this agenda is the scope of it. And there are many different ways you can look at this with regard to the kind of physiology that's done, the kind of social neuroscience that's done. But just in terms of sheer numbers, what you might find interesting is to go to PubMed and put in some of the terms that are used in this area. So you start with imaging. So if you put in PubMed and look for citations and you put in the word imaging, not surprisingly, you hit about 400,000 citations, because it means so much, so many different things to different people. But if you put in MRI or magnetic resonance imaging, you're close to 200,000 hits. I mean, that is an enormous literature out there. And I, of course, didn't bother to go through to check whether each one of these is a uniquely separate thing. That's over 20,000 pages of that. But then I thought, well, okay, fMRI, that's, or functional magnetic resonance, it doesn't matter which term you put in there. But if you put that in there, what you come up with is a number that's surprisingly similar. It's now close to 160,000 citations in the literature. So this agenda has absolutely taken off in terms of mapping the brain. If you put in molecular imaging, you're down in this area and PET at about 20-some thousand, which to me seemed kind of reasonable. The other numbers I was completely surprised at, and I've done this several times now. I'm dead sure it's more or less correct. So you have this almost scientific juggernaut rolling along out there doing this mapping, and I wouldn't want anybody to leave this room and think that I don't think that is an enormously valuable agenda of looking at what the brain does when we ask it to perform particular tasks. What I am arguing, that is only part of the agenda. And if I were to put ideas like intrinsic activity and default modes and so forth in there, the numbers would be well under 1,000 at the moment in terms of hits. And yet what the brain is devoting its work to is this intrinsic activity. But that's getting ahead of the story here. As this enormous agenda has gone forward, as I indicated to you at the outset, all of us have encountered decreases in activity that often appear in this particular set of areas, but not exclusively so. And the question was, what is this all about? And the usual critique of this was that it's just a poorly constructed experiment in which the control task that served in an imaging experiment like that just was contaminated with ongoing cognitive activity that you hadn't controlled. And that is a tough question to deal with if your control state is lying there doing nothing. So how are you to interrogate that cognition, that mind wandering, that stimulus-independent thoughts under those circumstances? And for us, this was a difficult problem, and it came to a head in an experiment which we tried to publish with these kind of data in it, and it was rejected. The paper actually has never been published. And it caused us to really wrestle with how do we deal with this. And what occurred to us at the time was two things. One is that if I go back to the slide I showed you a bit earlier, we, by this point, had understood what we mean in metabolic imaging terms as an activation in the brain. We have a signature of an activation in the brain, and therefore, if somebody says that a particular state has this, these areas that are activated, we ought to be able to define that. By that I mean that we should find in the brain areas, if they are activated, that have a blood flow that is disproportionately high to the ongoing oxygen utilization in the brain. Now, it's easy enough to say that. The question then is, what is the control state we're talking about here, and how do we define that? And this gets around to this knotty term in imaging that we have talked about and others have argued with us about it, but what do you mean by a baseline? And what I mean by a baseline is a physiological state. It is not a control state. It is a physiological fact of the brain or state of the brain. And what we know about this is the following, and this is important to an understanding of how one divides that which we call activations from that which we call intrinsic activity and deactivations. And it emanates from an observation that's been around absolutely for years, and it's true in as many species as it's ever been looked at, and that is if you take an animal or a human being and you look at blood flow, which is on the top row here, and oxygen consumption, those two maps are absolutely superimposable. And the relationship between those things, those two measurements are maintained, be it in underlying white matter or overlying gray matter, and within gray matter as these values vary over a considerable range. And so that if you then produce a map of this, of the ratio of those two, it is absolutely uniform. And it goes by the name of the oxygen extraction fraction, but the term is not important. The idea is that these are, so one could then ask the question that if you have candidate areas in the brain that in your control state, which is laying there quietly resting, you're positing that these areas are activated because it's not controlled, then they ought to have the signature of an activation. So simply what was done to get us over this hurdle was to take these areas, which today are referred to as a default network, and simply ask if this ratio differed in these areas in a way that would reflect the fact that they were activated in that control state. And the answer was a very clear no. So as we then looked at these, it began to suggest to us that there was an underlying structure to this activity within the brain that transcended the trivial cognition that must have varied from individual to individual and represented some sort of an intrinsic underlying functional architecture of the brain that was independent of a task. But we were far from showing that. Now, there was another issue that I think caused us to think a lot about this and, if you will, kind of shift my personal paradigm a good bit. And it was data that was generated from a number of quarters, not from me or our group. And that is to point out to the fact that when we see changes in the brain, they are exceedingly small. Now, just a few facts, and again, in this audience, it's probably almost insulting to say this, but I will. You know the brain's 2% of the body weight, and yet it consumes 20% of the body's energy. Now, one might simply ask the question, do these changes account for that? So it's always doing something, and so does that account for that? And I would just like to disabuse you of that notion right now. What you have here are PET images. So each row here, these are all the same people, and each row here is a different cognitive state. And it is a paradigm that is kind of one of the old war horses of the cognitive neuroscience literature, and I can assure you there are highly significant differences as measured by difference images in those images. And I would be very surprised, unless you, some of you probably have heard me use or seen me use this slide, that you would find them in there. So let me help you. Those are the states: eyes closed, eyes open, viewing words, reading words, and generating verbs aloud. So now you know. You know what they're doing. And I would still bet that you, even if you kind of know where these changes are, you're still hard-pressed. So let me help you out. There they are. And that was what was published in Nature in 1988, actually. And these are highly significant differences. But the point to be made here is that they represent very small differences in the underlying activity of the system. And they're even smaller than those images imply. And the reason for that is the fact that, again, coming back to this set of relationships here, blood flow goes up, glucose utilization goes up, but oxygen consumption lags far behind. So the energy that's represented here is being produced preferentially by glycolysis. And as you know, glycolysis produces 2 ATP, whereas oxidative phosphorylation produces close to 30 plus. So as one looks at the budget here, then, supposing you have a 10% increase in blood flow, this would be roughly equivalent to a 1% increase in the fMRI signal, and the glucose goes up in parallel, you have 1/10 of the increase percentage-wise in the actual metabolic rate. So we're talking very, very small changes as we look at this, and I would submit that when one puts an electrode in and listens to a neuron do its thing, that likewise, these are changes, and over the background in terms of what that brain's doing, these are small incremental costs to the system. So the question is then, what is the cost to the system? Where is the money being spent here? And there have been a number of studies that have been done, but I would cite two general classes of studies that are remarkable by their convergence. One is a study by David Atwell and Simon Laughlin, two blowfly retina people in England. And what they did was simply to do an accounting. They just said, okay, here's the glutamate molecule. It gets packaged. It gets bound to a membrane. It gets extruded. It binds to another membrane. It gets taken into an astrocyte. And every one of those steps, you can account for the amount of energy it takes to perform that step. And you know how many packets and all this kind of thing. And when they did all that and looked at just the processing of glutamate, forget about GABA for a moment, they came up with an energy budget for the brain of something between 60 and 80% of the cost of running the brain. And what's so striking, at least to me, is that we're talking about the cost of one neuron talking to another here. So that it's very likely this represents a highly important functional activity that's ongoing that is far greater than what we're talking about when we talk about these incremental changes. The parallel work that's, I think, been most interesting and complementary to this is the work done by Bob Shulman's group at Yale, where they used MR spectroscopy and labeled glucose molecules and tracked them through the system and said, okay, where is the energy from this going? And remarkably, they come up with a very similar set of numbers. So when one thinks about the cost of an incremental change and the ongoing cost of the brain, we're talking about functional activity here, but the vast majority of the cost of running this brain is in this intrinsic activity somewhere. So as I've now begun to think about this so-called default mode is a general phenomenon in this particular network, which some might care to call a default network, but more generally the brain, we're getting our first glimpse then of some sort of organization of this intrinsic activity, and I would kind of submit that it's certainly as important as the evoked. Now, having said all this, is kind of an empty sort of thing because the paradigm that we have in studying the brain, whether you're a neurophysiologist or you're an imager or whatever, is we have a task. We have to get it to do something and look at the responses. And yet the question on the table here is, well, okay, but if you're not doing that, the brain is still doing a lot of things. How do you how do you look at it? I mean, what's the question, and how are you going to get any information? So studying the intrinsic activity is no trivial question, no trivial problem. And there are a number of ways to think about this. I'm going to give you an imaging perspective, but I don't think it's unique. It's just what we have available, and it's been of great interest to us and somewhat of a surprise. This is an MR signal. This is a raw MR signal from a single individual with the eyes open, eyes closed, et cetera, up and down it goes. And so there's no averaging here. This is just what you get. And, of course, you can see the undulations here, and if you took that signal and you averaged it, you'd have an absolutely gorgeous signal that went up and down. But if you look at it this way, you'd say that is really a noisy signal. And, of course, the name of the game in most science is to get rid of the noise and look for the signal. It just turns out, in this case, that a big part of the signal is the noise. So how do we know this? Bharat Biswal was a physicist at the Medical College of Wisconsin, working up there in the group that did some of the early developmental work in fMRI. And along the way, he was curious, as a number of people were, about this noise in the MR signal. But he had the genius or the intuition to ask, is this related to anything else going on in the brain? So what he did, and this happens to be our data, but he looked at the left motor cortex, as I recall it, and here it is, a very noisy ongoing signal, and you're laying there, you're not doing anything. And what he noted, and this just again happens to be our data, but it could be anybody's this day and age, he discovered that in the right motor cortex, if he just asked, is that signal correlated with anything elsewhere in the brain, with no preconceived notion as to what it would reveal, what it revealed was that it was beautifully coherent or correlated with the activity in the opposite somatomotor cortex. I mean, this was just remarkable. And he published this in 1995, and I must say I'm stunned how long it took the rest of us to catch on here. I think a number of people looked at this and supposed that maybe this was maybe a vascular artifact or something. But when you do this, the robustness of this kind of finding is utterly stunning. So here again is your activity in the left motor cortex. And to give you a sense of what this looks like, if you haven't seen this, you look at this as an imaging experiment, and you take out things like respiration and cardiac pulsations. And when you clean up that signal, what you see is basically a functional map of the somatomotor system all the way down through the thalamus and into the cerebellum in a person who's just laying there, not moving a muscle. Now, again, you might say, well, maybe they're imagining moving a muscle, and I'll get to that in a minute. But images like this were really, to me, stunning. And but somehow or other, I guess I was part of the crowd. It didn't quite click, I think, with any of us how important that might be until an observation was made by a young neurologist at Stanford by the name of Michael Grisius. Now, as I've continued to show this picture here, this was something that set of images are rendered in any way, shape, or form I've come to know at a distance of at least a mile when it's in a room with me. And so what Mike Grisius did was to look at the activity in this system at so-called rest, when you're not doing anything. And what you find is if you put a seed region or you monitor the activity in the posterior cingulate precuneus and compare it to any part of the system, but for example here in the medial prefrontal, what you find out is again this system-wide coherence. And if you follow by just simply either taking this site or that site, here is the system revealed by its resting coherence. When I saw that image, I just thought, that is amazing. I mean, here you have a system that we are now coming to realize is probably a system of sorts, but there it is in all of its glory, not being depressed by an ongoing task, but sitting there oscillating at these very low frequencies in what I would call a resting state. And as you see, it transcends levels of consciousness. But it was even more interesting than that, in the sense that not only can you see the coherent patterns in that system, but you see anticorrelated patterns in another system. And what was really interesting about that pattern of activity is that you could identify that system, which has been otherwise called several things. Here it's referred to by my graduate student as the task positive system, and here's the task negative or default. The task-positive system, the one that's anticorrelated with the other one, is, in Maurizio Corbetta's and Gordon Schulman's terminology, the dorsal attention system. Now, what's interesting about this is that when you do engage in a goal-directed task, the activity in the dorsal attention system increases while the activity in this default network decreases. So their operational relationship is to be anticorrelated. But what you're observing in a setting like this is that behavior manifest in a state in which you're not specifically attending. So not only is it coherent within a system, but the systems to which it relates are related in an orderly way, even in the, if you will, resting brain. One can examine these things further, and I won't push this too much further other than just to, for those of you who haven't seen this kind of thing, just to give you a flavor. So here is the Corbetta-Schulman conceptualization of the dorsal attention system, which is represented bilaterally, and then a ventral attention system, which they kind of refer to it as a circuit breaker, if you will. So if I'm attending to a particular stimulus and something comes along, somebody calls my name out or there's a loud noise, my attention is broken from the act that I'm in, and I turn my attention to whatever is salient. The thought is that this is represented in a set of areas here in the right hemisphere. So one system is bilateral and this system is unilateral for the most part. And again, what's interesting, you can lay out the architecture of both of those systems as it relates to what's been seen in cognitive activation experiments. And yet this representation of that, those two systems and their relationship, which is depicted by these yellow areas, and I won't get into the issues that that represents here in the interest of time, but just to suggest that you could then go about, the impression I want you to get from this is you can go about looking at this beautiful large-scale architecture that is represented in ongoing spontaneous activity as reflected in a bold signal within a brain just sitting there. Now, one of the problems that one's faced with in thinking about this is the trivial explanation, that there's really nothing special about anything that I've just shown you, although I must say I have a hard time with the somatomotor system if I'm sitting there and not moving my hand and it's coherent, but fair enough. The attention system, how do we know you aren't intermittently attending? And because if you've read the recent one of the recent issues of Science, some people have suggested, and I think there's some merit to it, that elements within that default network play some role in, if you will, mind wandering and daydreaming and so forth. And not to expand on that, but just to suggest, well, of course, you're laying there, you're doing that. And hence, the explanation for this kind of thing is relatively trivial. And this really bothered us a lot. So we undertook an experiment, which hopefully will be out in Nature in the next week or so. And we reasoned that if this persisted under general anesthesia, then a trivial explanation like that just didn't stand up. So what we did was to use general anesthesia in a group of 11 monkeys. And we used isoflurane anesthesia, and we looked at two different levels, 0.9% and 1.25%. And when we first sent it in, we didn't have any EEG activity, and they said, no way. So we then went back and redid the experiments. And you get very typical EEG changes for this, slowing with the lighter level and then a burst suppression pattern. And this is a single monkey. And the primary focus at the outset of this was the oculomotor system. So you can see the four constituents of the oculomotor system in an anesthetized monkey laying there, obviously not using his or her oculomotor system. If you then average across all of these monkeys in the anesthetized state and look at the anatomy that's revealed by the spontaneous activity, you're now looking down on a dorsal view of the macaque brain. And you can see areas, the four areas that represent the well-known oculomotor system in the monkey, done by neurophysiological and other techniques. Of the 11 monkeys, this is two monkeys that are awake using that oculomotor system to saccade to targets. And I think what you can see is a remarkable correspondence between the spontaneous activity in the system and the evoked activity that's layered up upon it. And then to the right here is the connectivity within that system. That's work David Van Essen did that is part of this paper, showing the actual connectivity using tracer techniques. And the correspondence, the spatial correspondence between these maps, I think is quite remarkable. But it says very clearly that this kind of activity is a very much more fundamental property of the system. One can do correlation analysis within the oculomotor system and within the somatomotor system, and it's highly coherent no matter how you pair it up, and across systems it is not at all. Well, as this story proceeded with Nature, it took nearly 10 months back and forth with him. They kept asking for more stuff. And so we got to the point, and they said, well, fine and dandy, we've shown the ocular motor system, the somatomotor system, we want one more. So how about the visual system? And we had been planning to do this as another experiment, but it's in this paper. And the interesting thing about the visual system is that V1 has no direct connections to the V1 on the other side. So it's an interesting question. Would you see coherent activity if you put a seed region in V1 of the macaque brain? Would you see coherent activity on the other side? And so with David Van Essen's help, regions were picked in the macaque brain. You indeed see, here's the seed in foveal V1, and you do see a mirror focus on the other side. But what is also interesting is that you get area MT, and that's this yellow area outlined here. And you notice that it's in this part of area MT, and again, you see it on the other side. But if you then shift to peripheral V1, so you move the seed to this position here, you again see the mirror focus. And what's so very interesting about it is that the area MT that is coherent has moved. So this all behaves in a lawful way regarding the normally known anatomical relationship here and suggests the means by which information is going from V1 to MT to MT to V1. This remains to be sorted out exactly, but it clearly, again, demonstrates what you can do with stuff like this. And finally, we could not resist having a look at our old friend, the default network, to find out if, number one, a monkey has it, and if you have to be awake and alert to see coherence within it. And the answer is absolutely a monkey has it. This is the human default network, typical parts of it, even the medial, the hippocampal formation here. And here it is in this group of monkeys, and it's as clear as one can imagine, including the medial temporal lobe as well. What is interesting as one looks along the medial surface, one does not see it extend into ventromedial prefrontal. And that remains an interesting question. That part, as you can see here, is well seen down in area, the subgenual area, an important part of the human brain. And we know for sure, cytoarchitectonically, that the monkey has this set of areas down there. And I think it remains to be determined why one doesn't see that part of it. But I think it provides a very interesting way of going about mapping the monkey brain and also being able to compare these maps in an evolutionary way with human brain. And it's my understanding that former colleagues of mine at Harvard, Randy Buckner and Justin Vincent, who were involved in this study, have now done the exact same experiments in the chimpanzee brain, in anesthetized chimps. One of the important things in all this, of course, is that we have this ongoing intrinsic activity in the system, and I think it's really important and also truly fascinating to understand what is the cell biology and neurophysiology that underpins it. And to even begin to discuss this in any detail is far beyond the scope of this lecture and is also beyond the scope of our current state of knowledge. But I can just give you a hint of the general areas in which important advances are likely to be made. One of the things that's been extremely interesting is how the evolution of understanding of the, if you will, the cell biology of the bold signal has evolved. If one gets into this, you're talking about here a pre- and postsynaptic neuron and the astrocyte. And this whole idea of how the glutamate is recycled through here and is preferentially handled, particularly that aspect having to do with sodium-potassium ATPase glycolytically, is clearly a very important part of this. But one of the things that has been unstudied here, and to any great degree, but deserves our attention, and I gather people here are working on this, is also the role of the inhibitory neurons. And what's interesting here is there is this exclusive use of glycolysis in the astrocyte, we don't want to overlook the fact that in the postsynaptic density, the management of sodium-potassium ATPase and the phosphorylation of the GABA-A receptor is also supported preferentially by glycolysis. And sorting out the intricacies of this and then the cell biology of this and how it all fits together, I think, is truly a fascinating issue that has implications in understanding the bold signal. But I think without expanding on the comment, that it also has important implications in understanding issues related to disease in this system. The whole issue of oscillations, of course, is nothing new. It isn't news, so to speak, for imaging. It's an issue that has been thought about at all levels of neuroscience going back many, many years. This is a marvelous review by Yuri Basaki and his colleague. And as he says, clocks tick, bridges and skyscrapers vibrate, neuronal networks oscillate. And he goes on to talk about this, comment about this, and then in his more recent book, a marvelous treatise on the whole issue of oscillations and spontaneous activity that, if you're at all interested, I commend to your attention. But pointing out that there are all these different frequency bands existing within oscillators and so forth in the brain. And what we're talking about at the level of BOLD is something way down here. And how these different levels relate and interact, I think, is one whale of a nifty question. And I hope I'm around long enough to know the answer. And there's different levels that one might think about it. For example, and I saw some evidence of this today here, but you hear a number of people working on this. One way to think about it is that, well, frequencies like this or like this are unlikely to be transduced immediately into a BOLD signal. They're just flat out too fast. This signal can't, this blood vessels and that which runs it. But the power in those frequency bands indeed could be a means by which one communicates and that which is reflected by the BOLD signal. So one hypothesis put out by Brunson, in part supported by what I think to be a very important paper by David Leopold and their colleagues, suggests that one way that one communicates over long distances is through the power in different frequency oscillators in different places. It's almost like the brain is an AM radio station. And the beauty of this is that it allows what one might call jitter in a system like this. It has a number of interesting properties, but I'm not so sure that's really what's going on here. And one could take an even more fundamental, I think that should be explored. We should try to understand that approach, but I wouldn't think that all the money is going to sit there. Another way to think about this is that at a more fundamental biological level, and that has to do with what I believe Sterion first described, but it's been pursued by David McCormick and a variety of other laboratories, and that is the so-called up and down states. That is the transient cycling of excitability of neuron populations. And work with Sockman and Grinwald and others has been a group of papers that have come out recently that are very provocative in making one think about it. And, of course, these oscillations are close to the frequency of the BOLD signal, spontaneous fluctuation. Not exactly. But if an experiment just as an exemplar of this that really caught my attention was by Hans Sockman and Mehta. It came out in Nature Neuroscience a year ago or last year. And what they did was to record up and down states, that's these little reddish guys going on here, in the hippocampal formation of the mouse. And then in the mouse parietal cortex, they recorded local field potentials. And what's so striking is the relationship between those two at these low frequencies. So one might begin to see a synthesis of changes in neuronal excitability that have a certain frequency that when you're in the up state, entrain different frequencies depending upon the state. And one could begin to imagine some kind of a synthesis of this. But this is real hand-waving at the moment. But I think solving this, getting a handle on this, is really an exciting and important issue in this whole field. Finally, just a brief comment. This stuff is relevant, I think, to an understanding of changes disease processes. And just one very simple example. As you know, I earlier mentioned the dorsal and ventral attention system, and Bu He and Maurizio Corbetta and their colleagues recently published, it's actually out now in Neuron, in which damage occurred to the ventral attention system. And what we know physiologically is those two systems are interacting one with the other and kind of managing, as best we can tell it, our attentional resources. So the lesion is in the ventral attention system, sparing the patients were selected for this, of course, sparing the dorsal attention system. So the question is, what happened in the dorsal attention system, and how did that translate into behavior? And the answer is very interesting. So what they looked at then was the relationship between, say, these two areas here. And what you can see is in the acute patients, there was a very significant change in the functional coherent relationship between two nodes of that system that recovered over time as these patients became chronic, and the elderly controls are in the green. And what's so interesting about the data was that the performance manifest by people when measured against the pattern of coherence here that was being manipulated by that system was a most remarkable correlation. So one might see within the dynamics of this system and as they are altered, for example, means by which we could better understand performance deficits and the like. And I can't help but imagine, I mean, one can hardly miss a night's news about the terrible injuries, of course, that are occurring as a result of our current war. But one of them that is, I think, going to be epidemic, and that is the blast injury, the closed head injury. And the question is, when people come back with that and end up with these terribly disordered lives and yet could walk into this room and go to a cocktail party with you and carry on a conversation, and yet we put them in an MR scanner and look at them and can see very little in many instances, that the answer is going to lie in this fundamental organizational structure, which is both structural and functional. And so using techniques and approaches like this with these kind of ideas in mind, I think, could be very helpful. And finally, just I mentioned, and I won't belabor it, is that we find fascinating the notion that we could actually look, for example, at the ocular motor system or the dorsal attention system in humans and begin to see how these things have evolved over time. And there's no reason to believe that you couldn't explore this in many different levels. And again, you're putting animals, in this instance, in scanners in which you're not having to train them for a year to get the answer that you're looking for here. And finally, I think if one kind of broadens one's perspective here, that we have a much better chance of understanding, if you will, and I hope that didn't sound too presumptuous, understanding how the brain works. So the journey that I've been on here and my colleagues, many in St. Louis and elsewhere now, began by this problem, and that was that we saw these curious decreases in the brain, and we just simply set out to try to figure out what the devil they meant. And I was terribly bothered by the fact that people said that it was just trivial, we were doing a bad experiment, and these were just activations that we couldn't account for. I deeply believe that's the wrong way to think about this. I think it's a far more important issue that this, what might be generally called a default mode, is more appropriately addressed to the whole issue of the intrinsic activity of this system. And if I were a betting person, I would say that if I were betting on where the action lies in understanding how the brain works, that at the very least, this should be equivalent to that. And I think we have a reasonable chance of exploring that with the tools that we currently have available. And if this wasn't understandable, maybe what I've written is. So finally, I would just like to close by thanking the people with whom I've been associated. I've been in the St. Louis of Washington University since 1971. And originally, the neuroimaging lab was just me. And now we have 100 FTEs there and many graduates that have gone all over the place. And it's just been a wonderful place for me to be. And the people with whom I've had the privilege of working has been really phenomenal. And the graduate students that contributed to much of what I've talked to you about today have been some of the best people I have ever had the occasion to work with. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Certainly we have learned a lot about how the brain works, or try to think about how the brain works with what you've said, and you have really challenged us, as you said that you would. Questions?
Yeah. Very interesting demonstration of the sort of energy economy of the brain. What I was wondering is in the, the energy expenditure of the brain is relatively constant, but how constant is it? Is it down to, you know, the last decimal place? Or, in other words, if there's an activation, can there be a net activation in the energy utilization in the brain transiently, or is it you get an activation in one area and it has to be compensated for by, you know, a decrease in activation in the rest of the brain?
I don't think it's a zero-sum game. The question is, does the overall brain change? There have been, if you look in the literature where it's actually been reported in real terms that you can deal with, you begin with actually an experiment by Lou Sokoloff and Seymour Ketty at this institution, what was it, in the 1950s, no imaging. They just measured the AV differences in blood flow, standard old techniques, and they had people do mental arithmetic, and we know darn well it does all kinds of things in the brain, and they saw nothing. But there have been experiments reported where small changes in the overall global rates do change, but they tend to be very small. I've never thought the brain was a zero-sum game. That was the other explanation for the, you know, if something goes up, something has to go down. There's just a whole set of arguments that can be raised against that. I don't think so, not the least of which is the reserve of that brain, as measured in the extreme by a generalized seizure, is enormous. It's just many-fold greater than anything we're talking about. But in general, it's very constant. I think one of the intriguing questions is changes that may occur with sleep. That's a very interesting question, and I heard some fun stuff about that today, but it's early times. Thank you.
Other questions? Down to the microphone. Could I just ask, in terms of this sort of background activity, how much is just a sort of oscillation in anatomical networks, and how much actually reflects information that is being carried back and forth in a subconscious thought or subconscious type of activity as opposed to just an anatomical oscillation?
I don't know. This would be the honest to God answer. I actually took the slide out. You know, if you kind of put it in this, you kind of frame it this way, and I've done this a couple of times when I've talked about this and written about it. So what do you think the brain's really up to is kind of the question in part. And if you take that view, I think one of the most articulate people in talking about this was the late David Ingvar. He used to talk about it, and I remember listening to a lot of this, and he basically said, you know, you're in the business of mental time travel. You're in the business of being able to not only reminisce, but you have to ask yourself, why do we reminisce? It's kind of fun, but is it of any use? It is useful because it allows us to predict the future. So I would submit the brain is in the prediction business, and the minute you introduce that kind of a notion, then you can read stuff by Bruno Olshausen and many others who talk about the metaphor of the brain as a Bayesian inference engine, and that what is being generated in there is a construct of the world in which we live, and that which is being on, which is ongoing in a kind of a global hand-waving way, are the priors of that world. And so that it is, I think the thing that bothers me is the notion that our brain gets activated by the guy in the white coat, as if it starts at zero and gets turned on. And some people use the term turn on. It doesn't get turned on. It is always on. And so I think it's a much deeper issue than just kind of keeping the lines of communication open, even though you can talk of that as a component. I mean, there's issues of keeping the lines of communication open, balance on neurons. There's all sorts of levels of thinking about this. But part of it, I think, has got to be information rich.
Any other? Yes.
I guess I was just wondering, you have an increase in glucose in a certain area of the brain, but most of us probably know that the brain actually functions pretty much the same, even in high levels of glucose. Can you comment on that?
I'm not sure I quite caught that. You mean, in other words, it...
Well, hyperglycemia, for example.
In hypoglycemia?
Hyperglycemia.
So you mean what happens when that happens?
There isn't that much that happens.
That's correct.
Why is it then that you see these images that are glucose correlated?
Well, I think the evidence is in terms of why does the glucose consumption go up is best tagged to events presently in the astrocyte. I think the evidence is pretty convincing. If you put astrocytes in a dish and you expose them to glutamate, you get a big burst of glycolysis. And you can show that that's likely related to pumping of the sodium out of the astrocyte that goes in with glutamate. The question then is, it's also glycolytic to convert glutamate to glutamine. But the cost of that isn't quite so clear in terms of just that amount of energy. Because if you put GABA on an astrocyte, you don't get a burst of glycolysis. But GABA, as you know, is converted to glutamate. Then glutamine goes over to the neuron, and that gets divided between glutamate and GABA. So that is a clever... This is all work done in Switzerland by Magistretti and his colleagues. But, you know, what glucose is doing in this particular instance is related to those things. But what is this substrate? Where is all the rest of this? Where does the borderline between glycolysis and oxidative phosphorylation, and is there a distinction between the energy produced by one way or the other, and how does that get distributed? These are things we really don't have a good handle on.
Another question? If not, thank you once again for giving us good information about how the brain is working. And you're all welcome to a reception that is held back always there.